It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. We'll take a look at the polling numbers with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, The Nation magazine reported yesterday that a Green Bay city clerk raised concerns about opening an early voting site on the UW-Green Bay campus because she heard that students favor Democrats. The clerk shared her concerns via email, which one Wisconsin institute got through an open records request.
The controversy has raised questions about the role of clerks in voting and in early voting. Reed Magny is with us now to talk about the role of clerks in our elections. He's the public information officer for the Wisconsin Elections Commission and the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. Reed, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm not sure how specific you can get with this case in Green Bay, but talk about some of the issues that people have been raising when it comes to opening up early voting sites there.
So the judge in the One Wisconsin Institute case in late July issued an order that struck down a number of election laws, and one of those had to do with restrictions on where early voting could take place. Prior to the judge's decision, it either had to happen in the clerk's office or at one alternate location. The judge said it could happen at multiple locations. And so it was really, though, left it up to clerks to decide, do they want to have any alternate locations? If they do, where do they put them? And there were also questions left up to the clerks when to start early voting. Previously, it would have started on October 24th and been just 2 weeks before the election. Under the judge's order, it could start as soon as ballots became available, and some places started it in late September. Other places, like La Crosse, I believe, started it on October 17th. It varied from place to place, and it really left it up to the municipal clerks.
Yeah, there are fewer limitations on early voting, but there's no requirement that a clerk opens up alternate early voting stations. Is that right?
That's correct. It really depends upon, you know, the clerk. Do they have a budget for it? Again, this is a court decision that came out in late July. Most clerks don't have a budget to staff up separate locations. The city of Madison made the decision to do that. Milwaukee's Election Commission decided to do that in certain places as well. But again, it's really up to the individual clerk to decide where to put it.
And are there guidelines at the state level to help clerks make the decision as to whether or not they should open up a voting station? In this case, in an email that came out, the clerk cited a concern that this might be a Democratic stronghold that wanted this early voting station, but also resources, staffing, security, things like that. Are those things actually enumerated anywhere?
The state law about alternate absentee sites. So again, the law says you can have one site, and it doesn't have to be at the clerk's office. In choosing that site, you can't necessarily choose a place that would give an advantage to one political party or another. And I think the clerk was asking, maybe somewhat inartfully, I think that, you know, more students may vote Democratic out there. Is that an issue given what the state law says? And what we told her is that you can look at a number of different factors. And our understanding is that the city of Green Bay studied, you know, where they might want to have alternate locations if they were going to have them. But ultimately, they came down and decided we're not going to have any. We're just going to do it at the clerk's office.
We're talking to Reed Magny from the Wisconsin Elections Commission and Wisconsin Ethics Commission. He's the public information officer for both of those entities, the replacements for the old Government Accountability Board. Reed, are clerks, municipal clerks, kind of scrambling here, given that laws have come and gone? And in some cases, as you mentioned, over the last few months, there's over 1,800 of these municipalities in the state. What's the state of affairs as we approach Election Day?
You know, Wisconsin's clerks are really diligent people. They work hard. And, you know, we have a variety of different clerks. We have people who are full-time clerks, and then we have people in smaller rural areas who do the job. You know, it's a second job. They may work in town at a store, at an office, and then their second job is, you know, taking the minutes at the town board meetings and running elections. And if you have to vote early, you don't go to the town hall to do it. You might go into the clerk's house and sit at her kitchen table. So we have a wide variety of clerks, and 1,854 of them, and we have turnover. So there's always some challenges in communicating changes in election law, but they take it very seriously. We provide a lot of training for them, so that's the situation.
What kind of support do those clerks get from the Wisconsin Elections Commission?
We provide a great deal of training. We provide webinars about all sorts of different topics, about how to set up your polling places, how to handle absentee ballot requests, how to do, you know, any number of different things they need to know for the upcoming election. If they can't log on to that webinar when it's happening, they can go back and look at it later at their leisure. We provide a lot of different manuals. Our staff goes out to clerk meetings around the state and provides in-person presentations as well.
The big show, of course, is on Election Day itself, but Reed, from what you've seen, when it comes to early voting, are things working pretty smoothly?
So far, so good. We've had, overall, there's been 386,000 absentee ballots either sent out or voted in the clerk's office. Of that 386,000, 327,000 have been returned, and there are about 232,000 ballots that have actually been voted in person at the clerk's office. Those are pretty good numbers, and unfortunately, we can't really compare them to 2012 or 2008 because we weren't voting that early back then, and we don't have the ability to look at snapshots like this from back then.
Speaking of snapshots, Reed, as somebody who works in elections, I'm sure you follow very closely pop singer Justin Timberlake. He took a selfie, this is in the news, at a voting booth in Tennessee, so a picture of himself with the ballot. I understand laws are different from state to state. What is the case here in Wisconsin?
Rob, that was quite a segue. The law in Wisconsin is that it's illegal for you to show your voted ballot to another person. And the reason we have that law is to prevent people from getting paid for voting a certain way. You wouldn't bribe someone or pay someone to vote a certain way unless they could prove how they had voted, or at least it would be sort of a dumb thing to do. So the law says you can't show your voted ballot to another person. It doesn't say that you can't take a picture of it, but we certainly discourage people from posting pictures of their voted ballots to social media. It happens, you know, every election we get some complaints about it, we hear about it. I'm not aware of anyone who has ever been prosecuted for doing it, but you can bet that there might be a complaint filed with a district attorney or a police department if you do it. So we encourage people not to do that.
So I could take a picture of myself at the vote here sign with a blank ballot, but not that completed ballot. I should not be sharing that with anyone.
Right, and I'm not sure how you'd have a blank ballot outside the polling place, but yeah.
Oh, right, inside, yeah.
Right, and the other thing, though, is that a couple of states have actually passed laws against taking a picture of your ballot, and two different federal courts have found those to be unconstitutional because they violate the First Amendment. And Wisconsin's law itself has not been tested in the courts, but we generally advise people, don't do it.
All right. Great advice, Reed. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Reed Magny, Public Information Officer for the Wisconsin Elections Commission and the Wisconsin Ethics Commission, joins to talk about the role of clerks in voting and early voting here in Wisconsin. The countdown to Election Day continues just 13 days away from November 8th.
Harry Enten joins us now with the latest polling data in the race for president, the U.S. Senate, and more.
Harry is a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joins us each week at this time. Harry, welcome back.
Great to be back.
What is the latest in the presidential polling, Harry?
Well, Hillary Clinton led last week. She leads this week. She's held a consistent lead for pretty much this entire campaign. There is some argument perhaps to be made that Donald Trump has cut Hillary Clinton's lead just a little bit, but instead of her leading nationally by, say, 7 percentage points, she now leads by, say, closer to 6 percentage points. But either way you look at it, it's a sizable lead for her.
That's national polling. How about some of the latest in key battleground states?
Well, again, if you look at a state like Florida, perhaps there's been a slight tightening. But again, this is a state Donald Trump needs to win, and the vast majority of the polls have Hillary Clinton leading. Today, for example, there was one poll that got a lot of press, the Bloomberg poll that had Donald Trump up 2, but then there were 3 other polls that had Hillary Clinton up 3, and you kind of see that pattern across the states. Hillary Clinton's ahead in Florida, she's ahead in North Carolina, she's ahead in Virginia, she's ahead in Colorado, she's ahead in Nevada, and she's ahead in New Hampshire and Wisconsin, and with that, it's almost all but a cooked cake unless Donald Trump is able to turn most of those states around.
This is almost a quadrennial argument here, maybe a biennial one, I don't know. But there are some people out saying now, well, look at some of these polls. They're oversampling, overrepresenting Democrats in the poll, thus skewing the polls in Hillary Clinton's behalf. You've argued about this with people, I think, for years now, Harry. Talk us through the argument.
It's an argument. I would like to think arguments make more sense than this particular one. But essentially, pollsters do not weight by party identification. You know, pollsters ask, do you identify as a Democrat, Republican, or Independent? Pollsters don't weight by that. They weight by demographics such as age, race, gender. These are things that are fixed. Party identification can change. For instance, perhaps you are someone who voted in the Republican primary for Marco Rubio, and you really don't like that the GOP decided to pick Donald Trump, so now you identify as an independent. Those types of numbers, the party identification numbers, can change. What's most important is that pollsters weight to demographics, which are stable, and pretty much all pollsters do that, and the pollsters doing that right now have Hillary Clinton ahead of Donald Trump.
So in a year where, say, the Democratic candidate is doing well, some more people in the polls will identify themselves as Democrats on the thinking that they're voting for the Democrat.
Sure. I mean, that it's exactly. It's an attitude. It's not a fixed demographic. It's an attitude. Remember, 8 years ago, Democrats, there were 7 percentage points more of voters identified as Democrats in the exit polls than Republicans versus in 2004. In fact, the party identification was even. It wasn't that we necessarily had different people turning out. It's just that the people who were turning out claimed to be identify with a different party than they did 4 years afterward.
Now, speaking of attitudes, there has been some interesting polling trying to answer the question, are people voting for one candidate or are they voting against the other candidate? We've talked about the negatives, the high negatives for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. There's a thought that a lot of people are voting for a candidate just to stop the other one. Some polling tried to tease that out. What did we find out?
Well, essentially, we take the ABC News poll, which I wrote about, asks, are you, mainly supporting a candidate or are you mainly voting to oppose a candidate? And what they found was that the majority of Hillary Clinton voters, about 56% of them, said that they were mostly voting for Hillary Clinton because they liked her, not voting for her because they were opposed to Donald Trump. And that's about average going back for candidates since 1980. So it's not as if Hillary Clinton voters are more likely to say, oh, I'm just voting for the lesser of two evils compared to other candidates in the past. If you look at Donald Trump's numbers, however, and you look at the ABC News poll, you can see, in fact, the majority of Trump voters, in fact, are voting for Trump merely because Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee. They're not voting for Donald Trump because they like Donald Trump, which to me is so interesting because there's been all this fascination with who are the Donald Trump voters, why are they backing him? Well, the answer, it seems, for most of them is that they just don't like the other person running.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com. You can follow him on Twitter, by the way, at ForecasterEnten, looking at the latest news from the campaign trail. So some of the big news over the last week, Harry, Donald Trump is ending his high-value campaign fundraising, the kind of fundraising it sounds like that benefits the Republican Party the most, as opposed to his online stuff where they only get a small cut. What did you make of that development?
Well, I think it's just a continuation of the differences that Donald Trump has with the Republican Party and the infrastructure that's in place. Most Republicans, at least who work for the RNC, didn't want Donald Trump to be the nominee, and they have perhaps not been as friendly to him. Obviously, Paul Ryan, who is the leading Republican in government right now, is not a huge fan of Donald Trump's, and it seems that Trump realizing that he's trailing in these final weeks is lashing out a little bit. But I should point out it's very unusual for a candidate to cut themselves off to the party in this way. It's just a sign of how bizarre this year truly is.
Right. I mean, there's talk of the party, or at least some people like Paul Ryan, in a way, cutting themselves off from the Donald Trump campaign, too, saying, no, let's focus on Congress, and the implicit idea being maybe president, that's a lost cause this year.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I think there's almost a mutual recognition where Trump doesn't like them, and the insiders don't like Donald Trump, and Trump right now is going down with the ship. And look, Donald Trump, I don't really think after this year, if he loses by the margin, suggesting some of these polls, is going to have too much of a future with the Republican Party. And I think he is just fed up with them and is fed up with losing.
And the future of the Republican Party, there's been some polling on this. Who do you want to see as the future face of the Republican Party? Donald Trump's name is up there. Mike Pence is up there. Paul Ryan doesn't look so good, at least in one of the polls I saw. So that is that going to be a source of worry for the RNC?
It could be going forward, but I should point out that it's one thing to take that polling when Donald Trump is still a viable candidate for president of the United States, and it's another after if he does, in fact, lose. Voters don't tend to like losers, and we saw, in fact, you know, last time around that people, once Romney lost, they were willing to give it up, and, you know, even though they were very much Republican voters very much behind him going into the election. So let's take a look at that polling after the election, see where it stands.
You at 538 had a chat about the Democratic Party and a possible future split there between, say, a President Hillary Clinton and the more liberal wing of the party, Bernie Sanders supporters and others. What were some of the conclusions you came to?
Well, I think, you know, we pay so much attention to what's going on with the Republican Party and the divisions that are in there. The Democratic Party had a very close primary, and I think we need to recognize that the power right now is with the insurgents. You know, we saw Bernie Sanders come up from basically out of nowhere. He's obviously been backing Hillary Clinton, but it'd be very interesting to see once Hillary Clinton gets into office, when you look at trade deals, when you look at, say, the AT&T Time Warner merger, what happens? Hillary Clinton might be more for free trade, might be more for a merger like that, and seeing if there's perhaps a real anti-business wing, a more populist wing of the Democratic Party that comes up. And I should also point out, of course, that there are some real age differences and some real racial and educational differences within the Democratic Party that really we haven't seen in past years. And so it'll be very interesting to exactly figure out what happens when Hillary Clinton gets into office and whether there's some real pressure from the grassroots to keep her tied closer to more, say, liberal or progressive positions.
You've written in the past week about another party, the Libertarian Party. This was maybe going to be their year. Two major party candidates with high negatives, some higher elected officials, two former governors on the ticket led by Gary Johnson, was looking better than usual in the polls earlier. He slipped. What happened?
Well, I think that there were a few things that happened. Number one, obviously, traditionally, we do see third-party candidates lose steam as we get closer to the general election. People recognize that it's a two-party system we live in, and you have to choose one of the two. But I also think what happened was, you know, Gary Johnson, at the end of the day, was not a great candidate. He obviously made a number of slip-ups on national television, including forgetting what Aleppo exactly was in Syria. And then I would, you know, also point out that after the first debate, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, at that time, it really became a two-person race, I think, in most voters' minds. And because Gary Johnson wasn't on the debate stage, although it probably wouldn't necessarily have helped him given how some of his television interviews have gone, it's just a confluence of events, and his polling continues to drop. Now we're only projecting him to win 5.4% of the national vote. And if he doesn't get above 5%, it means that the Libertarian Party will not get federal funding in the future.
Let's turn to the U.S. Senate now. A lot of people watching that to see if Democrats have a shot to take control from the Republicans. What's some of the latest polling there?
It's close. You know, if the presidential race perhaps is a little tighter this week than it was last week, the Senate remains just very, very tight. Obviously, Democrats need a net gain of 4 if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency to take control of the United States Senate. Right now, they have two seats that look like it's going to go their way. Illinois won, and obviously in Wisconsin with Russ Feingold and defeating Ron Johnson looking probable at this point. That's two. But then there's a whole question of where do the other two seats come from? And they're very tight races in Nevada, in North Carolina, in New Hampshire, in Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Missouri. And Democrats look like they'll probably be able to get the net gain of four that they need, but it's only two-thirds of the time in our sort of model simulations that that occurs. So it's very, very tight. I can't tell you where those other two seats are necessarily going to come from, but it seems like they'll get them from somewhere.
How about the Donald Trump factor? How is that affecting Republican Senate candidates?
Well, I think that Republicans wish Donald Trump wasn't at the top of the ticket. We know across the states that Donald Trump tends to be underperforming how the Republican Senate candidates are doing. That's very different than it was 4 years ago, where Mitt Romney was, in fact, running ahead of most of the Republican Senate candidates. He is a drag on the ticket, where Mitt Romney perhaps was helpful. And if Republicans are able to hold on to control the United States Senate, it would be quite an amazing feat, given how poorly Trump is polling in most of these states.
Any polls that you're hankering to see, states that you think are underpolled that you want more data on?
I would love if we could get a poll from the Missouri Senate race, a reliable poll. This is a state that most people acknowledge is close. Our model has it as very close between Democrat Jason Kander, who's a 35-year-old who was in the armed services, a Democrat in Missouri, going up against Roy Blunt, the incumbent. The limited polls we have suggest a close race, but most of them aren't reliable polls. I'd like to see at least one or two more reliable polls to get a better understanding of where that race is.
Well, one thing, Harry, you're sadly not seeing this year is the New York Mets in the World Series. We've got a Midwestern World Series, Cleveland up now 1-0 over the Cubs. Have you picked a team since your Mets aren't there?
I have, this is the tough question. I went to a playoff game at Wrigley Field earlier this year. But that said, I think I am leaning towards the Cleveland Indians. I don't exactly know why. I think it's because it's the less cool thing to do, and I'm not that cool of a guy. So, you know, I have to go against the grain. So I am picking the Cleveland Indians, which right now is working out for me.
All right, and our apologies to our neighbors in Chicago. Harry, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joins us every week to give us the latest in national politics. A program that helps students with behavioral problems is showing a marked drop in suspensions at several Milwaukee alternative schools. Last year, more than 90% of students in the PeaceWorks program decreased their suspensions compared to their previous school. More than three-quarters of those students had no suspensions at all after a year in the program.
Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking developed the PeaceWorks curriculum. Pam Stoller is the coordinator of PeaceWorks, and she joins us now. Pam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, lay out the program for us. How does the program work? Can you walk us through it?
Sure. So the PeaceWorks program is a nonviolence education program. We work in both public and parochial schools, but specifically for the MPS behavioral reassignment schools that we're talking about today, we work with small groups of students and teach a curriculum weekly that focuses on different skills to help them develop conflict resolution and in nonviolence education, a repertoire for them to be able to use those skills.
And what are some of these specific skills that you're talking about, and how are they taking them to their world? How are they taking them home with them?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to talk about, actually. So our curriculum includes, we have a different focus every week. So we start with the practice of gratitude, and we talk about the brain science behind that and why that's important. We help them with anger management techniques. We work on positive communication and different skills that they can use for that. And It's always every year, you know, my heart is full when kids come in and say, "Hey, I used that positive communication thing we learned with my mom, and we didn't argue. You know, we actually talked." Or there was one student that always stands out to me. We do a lesson on grounding techniques, so that's where we teach them different skills that they can do when they're in that moment of really high emotion. So it's the mindfulness and breathing. And one of the things that we do is they make what's called a grounding stone. And they write a word on it, and it's a stone that they can keep with them. And they write a word on it that helps them to settle. And one of our students came back to school one day and told us a story about how he was about to get into, he was having a verbal altercation out on the street with some other boys. And he was about to get in a fight, and his stone was in his pocket. And he held on to it, and what he had written on it was the word future. And he said, I thought about my future, and I just walked away.
Mm. And you're seeing suspensions going down pretty dramatically for the students who are in PeaceWorks. Can you talk a little bit about these suspension rates?
Yeah, we really have seen a marked decrease in suspensions. And I think a lot of it is kids having a chance to learn these skills and practice them, and a place to go to talk about the challenges that they face and be supported. And another really important aspect of this is MPS and their support of programs like this. I attended an MPS in-service one day, and I was so impressed with the presenter. The example she used is, when kids can't read, we teach them. When kids can't do math, we teach them. When kids can't behave, we've suspended them. And MPS is really working on changing that traditional model, mm-hmm. and saying, we need to step in and help support students. No kid wants to get suspended, and so to help them to find alternatives and the skills to manage their behaviors. So it's really been a push, and we're so proud to be a part of that.
We're talking with Pam Stoller. She coordinates the PeaceWorks program, and that comes from the Center for Peacemaking at Marquette University. This program being used in Milwaukee public schools and some parochial schools as well. Pam, when you bring these students together in these small groups, several students, four students at a time, and you're really learning who they are as individuals, what do you find that they're really struggling with that, you know, could be at the center of these behavioral issues?
Yeah, I think there are several factors that come up a lot, and the kids are really open and honest about the challenges they face. I think a lot of it is this real lack of skills that comes from not seeing these skills modeled for them a lot of times in their neighborhoods and you know, in the people that surround them. So a lot of things that sometimes I might take for granted are new to them, and that's part of the learning. And another thing that the students talk about a lot is a lack of role models for them, and they have a real yearning to have role models, but also to be role models. We have our students talk all the time about having younger brothers and sisters and wanting to for them to be able to look up to them and wanting to be that person for them. And so you know, that's one thing that we try to do is give them not only the skills but also the confidence to know that they can be that person.
And when you teach them something like gratitude or empathy, these aren't things that are tangible. How do you know that they're getting it, that they're developing these skills, and they're really using them?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll use those two examples because those are such great ones. One thing that we do in our lessons with kids is every time we meet, they have a gratitude journal, and they write down three things that they're grateful for. And it's so fascinating to see the growth in that. In the beginning, a lot of kids will say, you know, nothing, or they almost always will identify, I woke up this morning, you know, I'm not dead. So that's something to be grateful for. And sometimes that's where it stops. And inevitably, by the end of the semester or the year that we work with them, they're coming up with, you know, five or six or seven things and very diverse things and new things. They challenge themselves to come up with new things every time. So we see that growth sort of just happening in front of us. And empathy is such a great one. It's one of my favorite things to talk about, and we bring it up again and again. And another just a really typical student example is where students will come to us and say, you know, about it, maybe a particular teacher, you know, Mr. A seems like something's really going on with him today. sometimes I would get mad about that, but I thought maybe he's got something going on at home, so I kind of just let it go. You know, so it's that language and those behaviors that really just show us that these are becoming a part of who they are.
And now, Pam, that you've been working with this program for several years, what have these students taught you? How have you been changed?
That is probably one of the most powerful things about the program for me, is how much they have impacted our life, our entire team. And I think the thing that stands out to me the most is that we have this wealth of youth in our city that is bright and funny and hopeful. And one thing that surprised me so much was I expected them to say, you know, when we talk about goals in their future, well, I want to get out, you know, I want to go to college and go make money and go live somewhere else. Because a lot of times their perceptions of Milwaukee can be really negative. And it really is just the opposite for so many of our kids. They say, I want to graduate and go to college, and then I want to come back. And I want to come back to my neighborhood, and I want to make things better, and I want to start a business here, and I want to give people jobs. And I don't know, you know, working with them and seeing that that's their intention in life, and that's their intention in our city and in our world, is really life-changing.
We're talking to Pam Stoller. She's the coordinator of Marquette University's PeaceWorks program that operates in several of Milwaukee's alternative schools to help students with behavioral problems return to traditional schools.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced a program like PeaceWorks as a teacher, a student, a parent that's made an impact on you, on your family? Are you a teacher? Do you see a need for programs like this, not just discipline, but behavior education? Have you seen other ways to fix behavioral problems in teens, in schools? You can add your voice to the conversation now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Pam Stoller. She coordinates the PeaceWorks program through Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking, working to help teens using alternative schools in the Milwaukee area to resolve their conflicts, learn behavior techniques that resolve conflicts and avoid suspensions.
You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a teacher, a parent, or a teen yourself, what questions do you have about this PeaceWorks program, and does a program like PeaceWorks make sense in schools? Call 800-642-1234. Pam, you have this interesting motto I've read. You say that peaceful schools mean a peaceful city. Can you kind of take me through what that means for you?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to back that up even an extra step. Because we start out with the kids saying, peaceful minds make a peaceful school. And then that translates into peaceful schools making a peaceful city, and peaceful cities make a peaceful world. So it really is that ripple effect, and where we start is with the students in their own minds and hearts. But schools are just such, we have such a privilege in our country that all of our youth attends school. We have our entire society in schools where we can help them and give them the tools that they need to sort of make our society what we hope for it to be. And I think that it becomes a lost opportunity if we don't use that to do some socio-emotional education and help them to really achieve what they want, not only academically, but both in the things that make life valuable, personal relationships and just basic well-being. And then that translates, of course, you know, that, again, ripple effect translates out to everyone that they touch.
And I understand you wrote this curriculum. Did you look to other programs around the country to base it off of, or did anything inspire you from elsewhere as you put this curriculum together for PeaceWorks?
Yeah, we had a PeaceWorks curriculum. PeaceWorks has been around for about 9 years now, running in different schools in both Chicago and Milwaukee. And so we had a basic curriculum, but we do still use that curriculum. But when we went to the MPS behavioral reassignment schools, we really found that we had to take a step back. It wasn't so much at that point about leadership and being a peacemaker in the world as it was, how do I just get through my day? You know, how do I get through my day without fighting with someone or losing my temper or feeling bad inside? So my background is as both a teacher and a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
So I really drew on those things and what I've learned about cognitive restructuring and different emotional learning. And also just learning from the kids. This curriculum has been a work in progress in that things will come up for the kids, and we say, "Oh, we need to write a lesson on this." Like they're asking for this skill now.
And what are some of those skills that they have asked for that they want to learn?
Yeah, we have a really interesting lesson which came directly from the kids. We would talk about positive communication and how to get along with people. And they would come to us and say, you know, there are some people in my life that I need to deal with, but I don't really want to have a relationship with them. You know, they're not people that are going to be healthy for me in my life, but I can't fight with them all the time either. But they're really hard to get along with. So we have a lesson called Dealing with Difficult People, in which I, you know, sort of did my research and drew on sources to figure out, how do you deal with somebody that just does not want to get along with you? And it's one of their favorite lessons because it gives them some language to use with people when you don't want to engage, but you also don't want to get it, you know, don't want to fight with them. So that's an example of something that came directly from them and from their needs in their life.
Yeah. And once again, you can join the conversation and call 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question about PeaceWorks or something that has worked in your community in resolving behavioral issues. And Pam, I want to ask you as well, how do you know that PeaceWorks is working, that it's not something else in these alternative schools that is correcting student behavior?
I think there are a lot of factors. As I said, I think MPS is very committed to trauma-informed care and training their teachers in that paradigm and decreasing suspensions. But I think the feedback that we get from students, which is overwhelmingly positive, we do feedback surveys at the end of our time with them, and they give us such positive feedback in terms of how much they like the program and how much they've learned from it. We also do training with staff, and we conduct professional development, and we sit in on staff meetings and teach staff these same skills so that they can use them in the classroom, not only to teach students but also for themselves. And we get really positive feedback from staff and administrators as well. And one of the things that students will say over and over is they'll tell us, why isn't this program in all schools? You know, when we go back to our new school, we would love to be able to still do this. And so I think that kind of indicates to us that it is definitely a team effort, that the teachers and administrators in these behavior reassignment schools work so hard and are so dedicated to kids. And I think that's one reason that they value our program, is they see that we're all on the same page, and this is one way, an additional way to help them.
And Pam, if people want to read up on PeaceWorks, find out more information, or get some material, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to the Center for Peacemaking website, which is at marquette.edu, and our contact information is there and all the information about our program. Marquette has been such a huge supporter of the center and of the program, and is just really committed to civic engagement. In fact, just won a major award this year, a national award for civic engagement. So they're really committed to helping Peace Works make a difference.
Pam, thanks for joining us. That was Pam Stoller. She's coordinator of the Peace Works program at Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking.
Election season has maybe not been a lot of fun so far, but a bakery in North Carolina is at least trying to sweeten things up a little.
The Owl Bakery is reviving a centuries-old tradition and trying to get people to make election cake.
Right, this is not just a cake you make on election day. It's a particular kind of cake with a history. It went back to pre-revolutionary times and then early days of the country. People would make this cake to lure voters to the polls.
To lure men to get to,
who
out
could
to
vote,
vote.
Right.
And apparently it tastes like fruitcake, so I'm
but less sweet. Apparently, so it's like it's a self-leavened cake, which means it's like a sourdough starter for the cake. Well, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Now it doesn't sound great, and there is fruit involved, but there's also, and this I think was a big part of getting the men to the polls, there was alcohol in this cake. It was like soaked in the booze. So we've got a link, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page to information and a recipe for election cake. Make it. Let us know how it turned out. This is Central Time.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, baked a cake, baked a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. How'd you do, how'd you do, how'd you do? Had you dropped me a letter, I'd have hired a band, the grandest band in the land. Had you dropped me a letter, I'd have hired a band.